From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The playwright Tony Kushner believes art should be engaged in public life. Not all art, mind you, but he is a firm believer that a stage, for example, is a proper forum for provocation and activism. Kushner's own plays are full of questions about politics and society, but you won't find any easy answers. Just because something is hopelessly complicated or tragic doesn't mean you run away from it, he says. This is why we have theater, the social occasions, he says, that we create to encounter these things. Today in the program, we're profiling Tony Kushner's seminal play, Angels in America. There are revivals of the production being staged throughout the country, including here in Salt Lake City. We'll talk about the play today, about the ideas of faith and responsibility and hope. Tony Kushner himself will join us. We hope you will, too, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to say exactly where Tony Kushner's play, Angels in America, came from. Kushner himself once described his first inklings of the idea as a dream he had in the midst of the AIDS crisis in the 80s. The play, which is set in the Reagan years, is about AIDS, but it's also about love and responsibility. It's been described as epic in its themes and in its mechanics. The production features an angel breaking through the ceiling of an apartment building. The old McCarthyite Roy Cohn features prominently in the story. So does a gay Mormon lawyer and his drug-addicted wife. There are revival productions of Angels being produced this year throughout the country, including here in Salt Lake City. The Salt Lake Acting Company was one of the first regional theaters to stage the play. All of this is giving us an opportunity to talk about a piece of theater that's become one of the most influential pieces of theater in decades. Angels in America, a gay fantasia on national themes, is playing at the Salt Lake Acting Company, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. You can join the conversation if you like. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The playwright Tony Kushner is joining us this morning. He has earned a Pulitzer Prize for drama, an Emmy Award, two Tonys, and an Oscar nomination, among other recognitions. His other plays include Caroline or Change. His most recent is The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures. It premiered last year at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. Tony Kushner is joining us today by phone from New York City. And Tony Kushner, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be here, so to speak.
I mentioned there at the beginning that the initial idea, at least as I understand it, I want to make sure I get this right, was kind of a dream you had. I think it was 1985. What was the dream like? Was it an image? Was it an idea? What was it?
Yeah, I mean, the original idea for the play wasn't actually the dream. I had done my first play, A Bright Room Called Day, with the Eureka Theater Company in San Francisco, and sort of left political progressive theater company, and they had asked me to do a new play for them. They commissioned a new play and asked me what I'd like to write about it, and it was during the first really terrible, the first few years of the AIDS crisis, and I had just come out of the closet when I was about 26, and I was about 30 at this point. So I'd been out of the closet for a few years, but it was still a fairly new thing, and I felt like I was ready to write about being gay. And since this was a San Francisco company, it seemed like a good way to start. Roy Cohn had just died of AIDS in 86, and so I was thinking a lot about him. I thought a lot about him all my life. And in the middle of all of that, I had a dream. I was working at a theater company in St. Louis, and I was thinking about the play, and I went to bed, and I had a dream about a friend of mine who was a dancer in New York who had gotten sick, and I had a dream of him on his bed in his pajamas with an angel crashing through the bedroom ceiling, and I woke up and I wrote a poem, not a good poem, that had angels and people with AIDS and Mormons and it was a lot of stuff mixed in, and I sort of the title for the play was kind of part of that dream in the poem, And then I called Oscar Eustace, who was running the Eureka Theater Company, who now runs the New York Shakespeare Festival in New York, the public theater, and said, I know what I want to write about, and I know what I want to call it. And I told him the title, and I started working.
Hmm. Do you think you understand now, Tony Kushner, why the play works for so many people, why it seems to have resonated with so many?
I mean, I think that on one level, I was a very fortunate playwright in that I think that the play arrived. I started working on it around 1988. I finished the first part, Millennium Approaches, around 1989, 1990, and then it was done at the Royal National Theatre in Great Britain in 91. And it sort of landed at the right moment. I mean, both... it was, you know, the crisis, the health crisis had been going on for, at that point, about 6 or 7 years, and the country had come a long way, not far enough, but from the early years when, in the Reagan administration, when there was absolutely no acknowledgement on the part of the federal government and in many local areas that were hard hit, no acknowledgement that this was happening. I mean, homophobia it still is a terrible problem. But back then, you know, this was a gay disease, and the religious right was, screaming about how this was God's revenge on homosexuals, and Ronald Reagan, to his eternal shame, didn't mention the word AIDS until 1987, and then only under duress, and never did anything to help anyone, even though thousands and thousands of people were sick at that point. By the time the play showed up, we had rounded a corner. I mean, there were certain milestones. Rock Hudson died of AIDS, and Elizabeth Taylor testified in front of Congress about it, and people were beginning to sort of acknowledge how disgraceful the public response had been initially to the epidemic, and people had also... many people were sick, many people who had died, and there was a need for, I think, a kind of a public place to go and mourn. And there were a few things that met that need. You know, the AIDS quilt, for one, and there were rallies and demonstrations. And then the play came along, I think, at a moment and sort of made a big splash at a moment when it was important, I think, for people to have a gathering place. And one of the places that they could gather, I think, were performances of Angels in America, and critics could write about their own experiences in the epidemic. I mean, so I think I benefited in timing in that way. Also, when the play opened at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, which was the last stop before it went to Broadway, it opened a couple of weeks before the 92 elections and the end, we thought, at least at that point, the end of the Reagan era. It was the Bill Clinton had just been elected president, and it was a very exciting time. We really thought that this incredibly calamitous political misadventure that had begun with the election of Reagan in 1980 was coming to an end after two terms of Reagan and one term of the first Bush. And we didn't know that the worst was to come, but at the time we thought this was a turning point. And I think that the play, because it is so much about the years that it's written, about 1985 and 1986, and is about Reaganism as well as about AIDS, I think it became a kind of a good rallying point. So I think it benefited in that way. I also think they're really good plays. I mean, we're doing a revival now in New York that I've been very closely involved in, and that the second part opens tonight. And I'm very pleased at how they've held up. How some issues that are in the play, like concerns about ecological catastrophe, even apocalypse, have strengthened over the years. And I'm pleased at the way that the play serves as a sort of a memory device for people who were alive and have a vivid memory of the early years of the AIDS epidemic and how terrifying that was. And for people to think about AIDS again, because AIDS, of course, is now a global pandemic. It's not that the problem has gone away. It's gotten infinitely worse. It's just moved, you know, to sub-Saharan Africa and places in the planet that Americans at least don't have to think about, or we think we don't have to think about them. So there's been a great vanishing of the issue. But, you know, when I wrote the play, I think there were 7 million people who had AIDS. Now there are 33 million. And it's a global pandemic that is going to have a horrendous toll on human life, on the economy, on the psyches of children who lost parents to AIDS. I mean, for decades, generations to come. So it stands up to the test of time, at least 20 years down the road it has. And I think it's a good play. I mean, it's entertaining, and people seem to be enjoying it. So I hope it's doing nicely in Salt Lake.
Yeah. Well, from our vantage point, I did have to ask you about the Mormon theme. I mean, why was it important that Joe and Harper and Hannah are Mormon? Because it seems as though you weren't just looking for any interchangeable religion that happened to be on the religious right. The fact that they were Mormons was important. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the time that I wrote the play, I didn't actually particularly identify LDS as a. I mean, it wasn't the most vocal or virulent of the right-wing religious organizations. It was, it has always been, you know, historically. Not of course in the 19th century, but in the 20th century, certainly the church has often sided with right-wing groups. But I mean, you know, you think about the Mormons in the Eisenhower administration and so on. I mean, they were sort of, back in the day when Republicans were actually responsible people, Mormon Republicans were responsible people too. And I didn't make the characters Mormon because I had a particular agenda about Mormonism. I mean, it's been an interesting thing watching the play now that after the really dreadful thing that the Mormons did in California supporting Proposition 8. It's changed the way the play is received to a certain extent. It feels more targeted. Yeah. I mean, the initial impulse was came from a number of different sources. I had taught in a school for gifted children in Louisiana. I'm from Louisiana originally, and when I was in college in New York, I would go back to Louisiana and teach at a program for gifted children. And one of my favorite students ever was a young Mormon girl who gave me a copy of the Book of Mormon and asked me very earnestly if I would read it, and I did read it, and we had a number of conversations. I was very moved by her, and I was, you know, she was a spectacular kid, and I felt that she had a really wonderful parenting and an upbringing, and I could see that a lot of what was great about her had come from her Mormon upbringing. I mean, very close family and a great deal of, you know, sort of lovely ideas about parenting that I think were Mormon ideas, and I was very moved by that. I think that's part of where it came from. I think when the angel crashed through the bedroom ceiling in my dream, it was, and I first thought of the title "Angels in America." I thought, well, you know, are there angels in America? What is an American angel? And of course, the angel Moroni is the American angel. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's. As Harold Bloom has said, it's America's only real sort of homegrown religion. I mean, Harold calls Joseph Smith America's only, I'm not sure if he says only, but he certainly says that he's one of, or maybe our only religious genius. I found as I did a lot of research on Mormonism, certain connections between Mormonism and Judaism. I'm Jewish, and... there's a history of persecution that has been shaping in the psyche and even in the theology of Judaism and also in Mormonism. There's a sense of exodus that's fundamental to both, I think, Mormon theology and Mormon culture and to Jewish culture. I mean, Joseph Smith consulted with rabbis when he was in Nauvoo, I think. And you know, in one way, it particularly moves me. I mean, both Jews and Mormons are people of the book. We have at the center of our faiths. For Jews, it's the Torah, and for Mormons, it's the Book of Mormon. But there's a way in which it's actually a physical object that I think it makes somewhat different than sort of other Christian religions. I think this is something we also share with Islam. There's a physical object that has a particular sort of iconic meaning and significance, and it's something that I think that our religions share. So that was a part of it. And as I've been working on Perestroika, the second part of Angels this time around, I've become more and more interested in a piece of Mormon thinking that I had used in the when I first started working on the play, the idea of being in the world but not of the world, right. Which I think is something that many devoutly religious people hold as a credo, but it's become a very interesting thing to me, the notion of being in the world but not of it. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's, I think, why, you know, why the play is has Mormons in it.
Mm. I don't want to get you off on a tangent, and I don't want to push my limits with your time, but I think I did want to ask you, don't you think it's odd that Glenn Beck, for example, is so ardently against socialism and the progressive movement, and yet there's so much of that that's deep in the history of Mormonism?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, and that's utterly... Is Glenn Beck a Mormon?
Yes.
Oh, my God, I had no idea. Wow. Yikes. Well, I mean, you know... It's not the fault of the Mormons. I mean, you know, he, that guy is a complete, you know, fraud. Anyway, I won't go. Let's leave Glenn Beck aside.
Okay.
I mean, yes, absolutely. There are radical social experimentations that went on in Nauvoo and then in Salt Lake, especially economic ones, yeah. Where there was a kind of a early pioneer socialism and you know. An economy that's not, in a certain sense, predicated the beehive image. You know, it's not predicated on private property ownership and individualism. And of course, that got you know crushed and buried. You know, in Mormonism as it is. You know, I mean, of course, it's ironic that somebody like Beck would be a Mormon, as it was ironic that Richard Nixon, while he was bombing Cambodia, was still a Quaker, and ironic that you know. You know, pick a religion. I mean, there's great hypocrisy and convenience. You know, I mean, the idea that people who follow, who profess to worship the man who spoke the Sermon on the Mount, why aren't all Christians pacifists? I mean, Christ obviously was. And there's a certain amount of temporizing from various religious prelates that will, you know, try and wiggle out of that. But he was a person who despised wealth, believed that poor people had a certain, you know, privilege in the eyes of God, and was absolutely a pacifist. And yet, look at what's done in the name of Christianity, or in the name of Judaism, or in the name of Hinduism. I mean, it's, you know. Certainly, you know, there isn't a religion in the world. Maybe the Buddhists, I don't know, but pretty much everybody else has a lot to answer for in the great hereafter.
Well, I know I'm pretty much out of time. Let me ask you this finally. You have this reputation for revising and fine-tuning. Is,
yes.
Is Angels finished?
I've done a lot of work on Perestroika. Not a lot of work. I've done some work on Perestroika. A lot of work on the character of Joe Pitt, who is a Mormon lawyer. You know, some plays, I've never changed Millennium Approaches since 1990 when I first finished writing it. I've changed Perestroika pretty much every time I've done a production that's been, that I've been involved in. And you know, there are just some plays that you can look at. I mean, I wrote Angels 20 years ago, and when I was 33, I'm now 54, and I looked at it again this year with this wonderful cast that I have in New York, and I thought, oh, well, I could do this differently, or I see where I didn't do something that I wish I had done, and I've changed it. So I think most playwrights do that. I've been working on a introduction for the new edition of Tennessee Williams' Glass Menagerie, and there are at least three or four versions of Glass Menagerie, and several versions of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And you know, I mean, I think I have a reputation for it, but I actually think it's something that a lot of playwrights do. You know, a play is a living thing, and it lives in existence. You know, in some between the audience and the actors, and every time you watch it, you think, well, what if it was this or what if it was that? There are at least four different versions of Hamlet, so I feel like I'm in very good company.
Yeah. Tony Kushner, he, of course, is the playwright of Angels in America and many other works, joined us today from New York. Tony, thanks very much for the time.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Angels in America, Part 1, Millennium Approaches, continues through this Sunday at the Salt Lake Acting Company. Next week, there's going to be a staged reading of Part 2, Perestroika. For tickets and information, call 801-363-7522 or just visit us online at kuer.org/Radio West. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Tony Kushner's seminal play, Angels in America. There are revival productions of the play being produced this year throughout the country. As Kushner mentioned earlier, there's one in New York, and of course there's one here in Salt Lake City. The Salt Lake Acting Company was one of the first regional theaters to stage the play, and they're using the play as a way of celebrating their 40th anniversary of theater. And so it's giving us an opportunity, as I said, to talk about Angels in America. We invite you to join us if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The Salt Lake Acting Company's production of Angels in America continues through this Sunday. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Kevin Myrie is joining us. He directs the Salt Lake Acting Company's version of Angels in America, and he's the co-executive producer, we should say, for the company. And Kevin is joining us here in the studio. And Kevin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
David Saverin is joining us as well. He's the chair of American Theater at the City University of New York. The Graduate Center there, the author of 7 books, has written extensively on Tony Kushner and his plays. And David Saverin is joining us from the NPR studios in New York. And David Saverin, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And Trey Graham is joining us, lead theater critic for the Washington City Paper in Washington, D.C., also edits and produces arts and entertainment content for NPR Digital Media. He's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. And Trey Graham, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin. I guess, David Saverin, if you would, put the play in context for us. I guess Tony Kushner mentioned it. This play emerges as the Cold War is ending, and I guess that's why it resonated. Just give us sort of a context for it.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important element, the fact that it appeared at this moment of crisis, not only in terms of AIDS, but the end of historical communism. And there was really a sense 20 years ago of a new world, of one world coming to an end and a new world being born. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that there's the crisis that we're going through right now is, of course, rather different. But still, I think that there's that the economic crisis has produced a deep sense of insecurity among so many people, which is one reason why I think it resonates right now. Mm-hmm. And another thing about this play is that it was great listening to Tony. And, I mean, he's a very hard act to follow. And but I have to say, I was thinking about, what an incredibly learned playwright he is.
Yeah.
And his plays, especially Angels in America, but all of his plays really look back to sort of the history of so many great plays, to Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams and Eugene O'Neill and Carol Churchill and Shakespeare, for that matter.
Well, don't you find it interesting that when he talks about Mormonism, for example, that, it wasn't just another sort of puzzle piece, plug in, and as I said, an interchangeable, religion from the religious right. Mormonism and their theology, their dogma, their doctrine was critical to the way he thought about all of that.
Yeah, and I have to say, when I first started writing about the play about 15 years ago, I knew nothing about Mormonism. And I was sort of astonished to read about the history of it and the way it arose in the 1820s and 30s and the connection with the Second Great Awakening, the pilgrimage of the Mormons to Salt Lake City. And I think it's so important the way that Tony stressed the way that Mormons were a persecuted minority, Joseph Smith being tarred and feathered. The other thing is that astonished me was to read how, for Mormons, that the Garden of Eden was cited in the New World.
Yeah.
And this notion of America as the promised land. And I think that the play so taps into that, to that belief, to that hope. I think ultimately it's a very optimistic kind of very hopeful kind of play.
Mm. Trey Graham, do you see it that way, the idea of it being about the American dream?
Oh, God, yes, actually. I was just going to ask you if I could jump in. Because to me, Pryor in particular, the main character, to me is almost an embodiment of the American experiment. Mm. He's rooted in the past. You know, that Mayflower lineage right. that he has and his ancient family, you know, some of whom keep appearing to him in dreams. But his instinct, when something fearful approaches, when he doesn't have all the answers, is to retreat, to take the angel at her word and sort of preach the need to slow down and stand still and achieve stasis. Mm. But ultimately, that is not what he chooses. And I think in that way, you know, and also tied to these ideas of migration and an ever-widening embrace, that are, you know, themes that are really important in the play. And that way, it is so in line with what we think of as the ideals of American democracy.
There's this scene, in fact, the very first scene with this rabbi who is... he's sort of pronouncing the funeral sermon, I guess, for Lewis, one of the character's grandmother. Mm-hmm. And he says, "You to the congregation, you do not live in America. No such place exists." And he talks about your clay as a clay of another place, you know, a Litvak shtetl, for example, or this ancient culture in this ancient home. What do you think that is conveying? Because it's a really lovely moment right at the beginning of the play.
Well, Tony has a way often of putting things in the negative as a way of sort of opening them up for questioning. Mm. So I really read that as a kind of question and provocation, as I read so much of the play. And I suppose over the course of the play, we really do see the creation of a new kind of America. That becomes complete at the end of Perestroika with that new community, that new family of people who are not, in fact, blood relations.
Right. I would say that's exactly the right take. If you remember correctly, I want to address this question, but I want to circle back to the observation you made about and that Mr. Kushner made about when the play emerged at the sort of the explosion of past the first explosion of the AIDS crisis, but at the fall of communism, at the end of historical communism, it begins with this ending, this funeral, but it ends with this speech that contains this magnificent idea that the world only spins forward, and a literal benediction from the central character, who turns and says to the audience, "I bless you. More life." So it moves away from that opening point in a way that I think is structurally tied up with the historical moment that it emerged in.
Kevin Myrie, forgive me for leaving you out of this conversation. I wanted to ask you about, were you around when Slack first produced the play?
Yes, I was. I did the set design for it back in 95.
So how do you describe the reaction then? I mean, what... A provocative play in many ways, and in Utah in the early 90s, with themes, controversial themes, certainly related to Mormonism. How did it play here?
It was opened wide towards the company, and ticket sales were great. There was no controversy around it. We just performed it. It was at that time. It was. Above the banner on the Salt Lake Tribune. I mean, it was big news to be doing this play because of all the themes that are in it and dealing with the Mormons that are in the play. So, I mean, it encapsulates so much of what Salt Lake Acting Company does all in one play because there are so many themes that are in it. And it also... It's a drama, but it's also comedy, and it has fantasy in it. So he really has just cracked open, you know, so many different themes and genres of theater within this context of these two plays.
Yeah, this is Trey. I'd just like to sort of jump in on that point. Mr. Kushner's talked about it as an entertaining play, or how he hoped it was an entertaining play. I've seen it four times, and it is terribly death haunted. And he talked, you talked, I think, about at the beginning about his idea that the theater is a place to go to mourn. Yeah. But this is a funny play. If you've never seen it, it's uproariously funny at points.
Yeah, Kevin, yes. You should make that point. I mean, that's really important because you almost wonder if you should be laughing because it seems like is that proper? But it's really funny.
Yes,
Hamlet's a really funny play.
That's true.
Likewise, in the New York Times, Patrick Healy had an article and called last week if there was any protest going on in conjunction with doing this play here in Salt Lake.
Seemed surprised that there wasn't.
Yeah, yes, and no, there wasn't. I mean, we have a very smart audience that attends our plays, and they go for the ride.
I think it's really interesting. This is Trey again. I think it's really interesting that you said the response in 95 was that positive, too. There was a production in North Carolina, as that New York Times article noted, that caused tremendous controversy for a company in Charlotte. There was a production in my memory here in Washington, D.C., that it was a student production at Catholic University, which has a strong drama program at a place where you would think this kind of thing would be available for exploration. But the students had to move it off campus, as I recall, and had to perform it in the basement at Arena Stage here in D.C.,
Well, I do think that in the 20 years since the play was written, that people's attitudes toward gay politics have really, really changed. When you consider, I think, the statistics now that, in fact, most people approve of gay marriage. That was most emphatically not the case 20 years ago. Mm. So, you know, it's a different context. And I think also, you have to remember that theatergoers are a self-selecting audience. Yeah. And they tend to be more liberal and urban and upper middle class. And I think that's part of it, too.
Well, I wanted to actually raise the question of this idea of preaching to the choir, which I think Tony Kushner has said once or twice that he doesn't mind preaching to the choir, but there's this theme in the play, and I wanted to get your perspective on it. David Severin, you've talked about how the play sort of submits liberalism to this really deep examination, and this idea of ambivalence. Mm-hmm. What is he getting at there? Because I think that does make you feel uneasy.
Yeah, the fact is, ultimately, I think that the play really comes down strongly on the side of liberalism and multiculturalism and especially progress, a real belief in progress. But it does so by interrogating all of these in a really radical and at times unsettling way. How can we talk about progress when all of these people are dying of AIDS, for example? Lewis's position about politics and about pretty much everything is not very coherent. I mean, he's really contradictory. Mm. And there are all of these interesting contradictions that run throughout the play. And again, I really think of it as a kind of act of provocation. And that's why I don't see it as sort of preaching to the choir, but it's about making us really think deeply about these very important questions.
Kevin, what was? How do you see Lewis? I mean, the issue here, Lewis. He and I guess we should say, I don't know how much to say. I never know quite at this point. It's such a classic piece of theater, but there are going to be a lot of people who encounter it for the first time. But let's just say this: the question of responsibility is important for Lewis. And what do you make of that character?
With Lewis, he is searching for his identity. I mean, as all these characters are in the course of the play, Lewis's struggle is coping with his partner's illness, as is essentially it. And it's hard to make him sympathetic. You know, because I remember back in 95, my reaction to Lewis was a lot different than it is today.
What do you mean?
I mean, back in
95. You hated him then.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was just like I couldn't get beyond that point of how could he. But then I guess with 15 years of my own experience, life experiences, that I embrace him differently. And I that was my approach to it this time as well. He's more than just that. I mean, he is searching for a better America, a better universe, as well as a better self.
Go ahead. I was going to say, David or Trey, did you have experienced that too? Did you let Lewis a little bit off the hook as the years passed?
Yeah, I think Lewis is a, this is Trey. Lewis is a profoundly tragic character, and I think it's his journey as much as Pryor's that Kushner is interested in. Go ahead.
No, I agree, and I mean structurally, Lewis is at the center of the play. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's the one who knows everybody else in the play, mm-hmm. And I do think that it's every bit as much his journey as it is Pryor's.
I think it's fascinating too that in the New York revival right now, it's, you know, this play has come so far in the sort of public mind, you know, in terms of its accessibility and its place in the canon, that the character of Lewis is being played by a young and still rising star from the world of television and movies. You know, Zachary Quinto is the guy who played Spock in this very expensive Star Trek movie that's just a year or two old, and it's a character I believe he's going to repeat. So, you know, he's stepping into this deeply tormented character, and it's, you know, this is a move that would have been tremendously controversial for someone like him at the time the play premiered, and I don't think it is anymore.
Well, also, I think that the HBO version, that Mike Nichols' production, I mean, more people saw that, after all, than have ever seen the play on stage.
Yeah.
And I think it was actually really pretty fabulous television. And that, so a lot of people have gotten to know the play, and I think there's a greater comfort level with it now than there was 20 years ago.
There's a question from one of our listeners, Craig, who's in Draper, who wants to know what the difference is between the production, apparently, that he saw on HBO and the way it's staged. How are the experiences? Kevin Myrie, you first. How are those different?
One of our subscribers came up and said that he had just recently watched the HBO one right before coming to our play, and he said that the TV miniseries is so visual, but the play, you get the language of Tony Kushner easier, that it's more accessible, and it's about following the language more as opposed to the visual. And I think that just comes across in the production as well, of doing the theatrical version versus the TV version.
You know, it's interesting, David Severin and Trey Graham, when you hear Kushner talk about the difference between playwriting and screenwriting, for example, I mean, he sees them as two entirely, in many ways, entirely different pursuits. Mm-hmm. So how does it come off, you know, on the screen? I mean, it's terrific, it's gorgeous, and it's great, but what's the difference between that experience and seeing it live there on the stage?
This is Trey. I think that in theater, you can do so much less in terms of physicality because the language will carry the emotions and spark the visuals in your head. I've seen this, as I said, four times, and I've seen it in a mid-sized theater. I saw the Broadway production, and I saw it last year in a tiny little black box theater that had almost nothing in the way of sets, just a giant fabric drape at the back of the stage. And you know, tables and chairs and beds and park benches that sort of rolled on and off as they were needed. And it was every bit as effective in that tiny little black box space with committed performers digging into these characters. And I think that's what theater is different. If you try to produce it in a black box space and film that and put it on television for people, I don't think that would work.
Mm. David Severin.
Yeah, this is David, and I agree with Trey. And especially what he said about committed performers, because, you know, there's something about having live actors on stage who are really going through something.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in the same room with them. And that's, I think, a completely different kind of experience from what you have in television or movies, for that matter.
David Savran is with us. He's the chair of American Theater at the City University of New York's Graduate Center, joining us from New York. Trey Graham is with us, an NPR arts editor and theater critic for the Washington City Paper in Washington. Kevin Myrie here with us in the studio. He directs Salt Lake Acting Company's version of Angels in America. Millennium approaches. It continues through this Sunday at the Salt Lake Acting Company. Next week, we should say, there's also going to be a staged reading of Part 2, Perestroika. Tickets and information, you can just visit our website and get details at KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Tony Kushner's play Angels in America. As we mentioned, there are revival productions of the play being produced throughout the country, including one here in Salt Lake City, the Salt Lake Acting Company. It's giving us an opportunity to talk about the play. David Savran is joining us, chair of American Theater at the City University of New York. And Trey Graham, NPR arts critic and theater critic, for the Washington City Paper in Washington, D.C., and the director of the play for the Salt Lake Acting Company, Kevin Myrie, joining us here in the studio. I want to give people a sense of what I want to play a clip, if we can, from the play. And Kevin Myrie, help us set this up. This is the scene between Harper and Joe. And we should say Joe, the husband and wife, Mormon couple. Joe's very much a Reaganite, very conservative lawyer. Harper is addicted to Valium and pretty fragile as a character. And Joe, it turns out, is wondering about his identity, his sexual identity. Say something about Joe and Harper, if you would. And David, I'll have you and Trey talk about this too before we play the scene.
They're both from Salt Lake, and they, as their forefathers came to Salt Lake to find Mecca, had to move to New York to try to find out who their identities really are. So their journey is there, and leaving the strong church ties behind. Fortunately, Harper has had a bad childhood, and has married a gay man who hasn't come out of the closet yet. And so her vice of to escape the reality is being addicted to Valium.
David Trey, anything you want to say about this relationship?
Go on, Trey. I was going to say, the first couple of times I saw the play, I was not as drawn into that particular plot line as I was the last time. That tiny little black box production I mentioned earlier sort of put the focus on the relationships in a way that I hadn't experienced before. And it's the portrait of Harper and Joe is so tender, and it's so generously and charitably handled in the end that, you know, this is one of the reasons I think the play is going to be a sturdy element of the theatrical canon, certainly of the American theatrical canon, because I find new things in it each time I see it, and it just sort of dazzles me at Kushner's gift for looking at people and digging into their heads and sort of flaying them open and putting their insecurities out there and inviting you to want to help them.
David?
One thing that I find really moving about Joe and Harper is that, in fact, Harper and Pryor are really doubles in this play. I mean, they appear in each other's dreams. And there's a sense of both of them as, diseased, really. I mean, different kinds of disease. And the fact that both of them make such progress in the course of the play. I mean, they're the two characters who are really transformed. And it's interesting that Joe isn't really. And he's not, in that final scene of Perestroika, he's not there. Yeah. He cannot be a part of the new family.
They're Harper and Pryor, their relationship, their lives are interconnected, as you were saying. And when one of these moments of revelation, they reveal these secrets about each other's lives. And one that Pryor has for Harper is the revelation, which she must have sort of intuitively understood, is that her husband is gay. Here's a scene from Angels in America.
I think we ought to pray. Ask God for help. Ask him together.
God won't talk to me. I have to make up people to talk to me.
I have to keep asking.
I forgot the question. Oh, yeah. God, is my husband a homo?
Stop it. I'm warning you. Does it make any difference that I might be one thing deep within? As long as I have fought with everything I have to kill it? What do you want? What do you want from me, Harper, more than that? For God's sake, there's nothing left. I'm a shell. There's nothing left to kill. As long as my behavior is what it ought to be. Decent, correct, that alone in the eyes of God.
No, not that. That's Utah talk, Mormon talk. I hate it, Joe. Tell me. Say it.
All I will say is that I am a very good man who has worked very hard to be good. And you are trying to destroy that. You're trying to destroy me. I'm not going to let you do that.
I'm going to have a baby.
Liar.
You liar. A baby born addicted to pills. A baby who does not dream, but who hallucinates, who stares up at us with big mirror eyes and who does not know who we are.
Are you really?
No. Yes. No. Yes. Get away from me. Now we both have a secret.
Scene from Angels in America, which is now playing at the Salt Lake Acting Company in Salt Lake City. I wanted to ask about, I don't think we have time to play this scene from Roy Cohn, but I'm really intrigued by sort of his identity, the sense of who he is. David Severin, say something about the Roy Cohn character. He's such an intriguing, nasty, yet vulnerable figure.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, he's the one historical character in it, and he's this, you know, incredible virtuoso and played by virtuoso actors like Al Pacino. Mm. And he's a monster and also very sympathetic. I mean, one thing that I think is so important about having Roy Cohn, and I mean, it's odd to write a fictional play with a real historical character in it. But I think one of the reasons why Roy is there is because of the way that the personal and the political intersect. Because the play is so much about that, and it's in Roy that, and in the people around him, I think that becomes clearest.
Well, Roy, I think this is Trey. Roy is the perfection of Joe. Mm. He's what Joe will metastasize into if he continues on the path that he's on. You heard Joe in that clip talking about, I do what I'm supposed to do. I do what the rules say. Yeah. And the connection between them is that they're both so about the pure letter of the law, and as long as you don't step outside that, you can do whatever you want in your personal life, and the law can't touch you, or the commandments can't touch you, right? Mm. And Roy, of course, has stepped outside the law, and he gets disbarred in the course of the play. And I think that's one of the things Kushner wants you to confront, the idea that this notion of playing by the rules without the moral core that informs the rules and the law is ultimately not a workable thing.
Right.
You know, I wanted to ask you this idea of the sense of kind of political activism and, you know, provoking. David Severin, well, all of you, let me just get you on this question of, is there, I think Kushner's sense has been, I'm not sure, I was going to ask him if we would have had the time, he's been not entirely satisfied with American theater, not doing enough of this kind of theater. Is he right, David Severin?
Well, I mean, I do think that, I mean, I see a lot of theater in New York pretty much every night, and you know, there's a huge range of things that I see, but I do think that American theater has in fact gotten more political the past few years, in part as a response to Bush and the Iraq War. And I mean, I've seen a lot of anti-war plays, but also, you know, sort of plays taking off from that and bringing up larger questions. And I mean, I think a lot of political plays are being written. I'm not sure that all of them are that good, but or compare with Angels, which is, I think, just a much richer work than, you know, 98% of what's out there.
Yeah, Trey Graham.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of political plays being written. I'm just not sure there are a lot of Tony Kushners writing them.
Right.
There are some wonderfully gifted people who are profoundly engaged, who have sort of come up in his wake. You know, Naomi Wallace, Terrell McCraney, Lynn Nottage, who's ruined Took Home the Pulitzer Prize. And that's, you know, that's a profoundly political play.
Of course, yeah.
It's not necessarily concerned with American politics, but the global politics of it are right out there on the surface.
Right.
Sarah Rule. There are some wonderful young American playwrights working in this kind of arena, which you touched on earlier, you know, the notion of theater as offering these, I think the phrase was social occasions where we encounter these things. Mm. And I think that's profoundly important. It's where theater started, after all. The audiences for the Greek tragedies had fought in the wars that were being dramatized on stage, and some of the playwrights had fought in the wars. And that, you know, that sense of public conversation about important issues is should be core to theater. It shouldn't just be about diversions and entertainment.
Kevin Bell.
And I think it is still really important in theater.
Yeah. And what I think Tony's done brilliantly with this is that has taken this political stance and made it so personally interwoven with all these various characters. Mm-hmm. And it is their personal stories that you follow through their political sides.
Right.
Kevin Myrie, he directs Salt Lake Acting Company's version of Angels in America. Trey Graham, NPR's arts editor, an NPR arts editor, I should say, a theater critic for the Washington City Paper in Washington, D.C. David Saverin, chair of the American Theater at the City University of New York's Graduate Center. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
And go to our website for details about the Salt Lake Acting Company's productions. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.